This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 26th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up, we'll be speaking to journalist Patrick Coburn about his views on President Assad's resilience in Syria. And we shift our gaze to India, where the member of a former royal dynasty is fighting to retrieve a long-lost jewel.
Wherever there's money in a family, there's a fight. And in India, there isn't a system of primogeniture like we have here, which makes a dispute small bitter.
And we'll be travelling to Tokyo to hear from Nick Luscombe, the man behind Musicity, a project attempting to reflect architecture in music.
I think every city has got its own musical story to tell, so we'll hope to uncover all those different cities, big or small, in the coming years.
All that, plus some great music as well, all in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. First, though, let's get the news from around the world with Georgina Godwin.
Monocle 24 News. NATO officials have confirmed that an Afghan army soldier killed two British troops at their headquarters in southern Afghanistan today. So-called insider attacks have mounted recently as tension between Afghanistan and its foreign backers rises over a series of incidents, including the burning of Qurans at a NATO base and a massacre of 17 villages for which a US soldier was charged. No group has claimed responsibility for this attack. The latest deaths bring to 407 the number of British soldiers killed in Afghanistan. About 70 members of the NATO force have been killed in 42 insider attacks from May 2007 to January this year. The shootings raise new concern about the reliability of Afghan forces and their ability to take over security responsibilities by the end of 2014, when most Western combat forces are to leave. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao have agreed to coordinate closely in responding to any potential provocation of a planned North Korean rocket launch. The two leaders met today on the sidelines of a global nuclear security summit in Seoul. The White House said President Hu has indicated that he is taking the North Korean issue very seriously and will register China's concern with the government in Pyongyang. Still at the summit in Seoul, President Obama and his Russian counterpart Dmitry Medvedev said they are agreed on the best way to end the bloodshed in Syria. Kofi Annan met Medvedev yesterday and said that the crisis in Syria cannot drag on indefinitely, but that he could not set a deadline for a resolution after a year of bloodshed. He spoke to reporters after the meeting.
Time is of the essence. This cannot be allowed to drag on indefinitely. And as I have told the parties on the ground, they cannot resist the transformational winds that are blowing. They have to accept that reforms have to come, change has to come, and that is the only way to deal with the situation.
Israel has announced that it has severed contacts with the UN Human Rights Council after it launched an international investigation last week into Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The decision means that the fact-finding team the council planned to send to the West Bank will not be allowed to enter the territory or Israel. A foreign ministry spokesman announced the decision.
With its disproportionate obsession about Israel, bypassing totally unthinkable number of condemnations on Israel and Israel only, or almost only, the Human Rights Council has made all cooperation with it completely useless. They have made the situation as it is now, and we have therefore decided to sever our working ties with this body until further notice.
The international investigation was launched last Thursday, and the US was the only state to vote against the initiative, which was brought by the Palestinian Authority. Senegalese opposition candidate Macky Sall has emerged as the winner of yesterday's presidential election. Sall had campaigned on lowering the cost of living for Senegalese. He'd criticised long-serving leader Abdoulaye Wade for pursuing vanity projects instead of helping poor Senegalese, and promises he will deliver a new era for the country. Wade admitted defeat in the presidential election, congratulating Sall, a move seen as bolstering the West African state's democratic credentials in a region fraught with political chaos. And a Turkish shampoo commercial featuring an enraged Adolf Hitler is a huge insult to human rights and should be withdrawn, leaders of the country's Jewish community said on Monday. The 13-second television spot for BioMen shampoo shows black and white archival footage of the Nazi leader at a political rally. Dubbed in Turkish, he shouts that men should not use women's shampoo. Jewish leaders have expressed concern about rising anti-Semitism in Turkey since relations with Israel, a former military ally, soured after the 2010 raid by Israeli commandos of a Turkish-led humanitarian aid ship bound for Gaza. 9 Turkish activists, one with dual US citizenship, died in the raid. The New York-based Anti-Defamation League said it was repulsed by the use of Hitler's image to sell shampoo. And those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, Georgina. Just looking at the front pages reaching the kitchen tables in Australia and New Zealand this morning. We'll start with the Sydney Morning Herald. And they also, along with The Age, go with Julian Assange's promises. If he's to reach the Senate, he's on a bit of a publicity campaign, it seems. And he says he'd be a fierce defender of free media. If he was successful in his bid for a Senate seat, he would dedicate his time to breaking the court suppression orders and other excessive constraints on free access to information. He's not yet decided which state he'll stand, but he says he has several options, having lived in Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. Mr. Assange has also been under house arrest in Britain whilst he awaits a British Supreme Court decision on his appeal against extradition to Sweden. Also on the Sydney Morning Herald, they cover the opening of the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia, just in Circular Quay, and it's been welcomed by the art world, this $53 million redevelopment after 18 months in the making. Finally does the art justice, according to those that attended the launch. It opens to the public on Thursday. And also on The Age, carbon targets scrapped. This is an end to the plans in Victoria to impose greenhouse gas emissions taxes of 20% over the next decade. That target is said to be scrapped by local government. The New Zealand Herald and the Press both go on Cairns awarded $950,000 in libel action. This is cricketer Chris Cairns, pictured on the Herald with his wife in London, taking Lalit Modi to court in a landmark case involving allegations made on Twitter. Lalit Modi, the Premier League commissioner, former Indian Premier League commissioner, had alleged that Chris Cairns had not only cheated on his wife, but had also been involved in match fixing. These allegations go back to January 2010. And he won his case. Chris Cairns was awarded £174,000 compensation, £775,000 in court costs. But both papers point out that Lalit Modi was very recently declared bankrupt. So it throws into doubt whether or not those legal fees will be paid and whether or not Chris Cairns will get any compensation. Also on the Press, work on cathedral demolition underway. This is the Christchurch Cathedral, already being taken apart now, to the dismay of the Wizard of New Zealand, who continues to fight this demolition and continues to collect signatures. He says that the heritage was being destroyed left, right and centre. Those are your front pages in New Zealand and Australia. It's 8 minutes past here. Let's get the global weather now with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
In Western Europe, it feels like mid-May. Here in the UK, we've been beating some temperature records. It'll stay warm and sunny in London most of this week. France also enjoying the good weather, up to 25 degrees in the south of France. Alps, sunny, and also sunny across much of the Mediterranean. But if you're in business in Moscow, it's still wintry, actually colder than normal. On to Tuesday's City Outlook. In London and Frankfurt, 19 degrees and sunny. Paris, 21 with blue skies. Rome, 22, also sunny. But in Helsinki, only 6 degrees and partly cloudy. North America now. And fine weather for eastern Canada and the eastern US this week. Sunshine the next couple of days. In fact, all the way from Montreal in the north, across the eastern seaboard, right down to Florida. California, not doing so well. In fact, the last few weeks have been very disappointing in California. You might be heading to San Francisco right now. Certainly some rain on the way. So here is Tuesday's City Outlook. And in San Francisco, rain and 14 degrees. But New York City, 12 and sunny. Washington, D.C. Tennessee, 14, some sunshine. Chicago, around 20, but a chance of thundershowers here. And around the globe, early this week, Sao Paulo. Recently, it's been up to 30 degrees and sunny. A change on the way. By Wednesday in Sao Paulo, much cooler and it's looking wet. How about Cape Town? A mix of sun and clouds here, 25 degrees. And in Sydney, a shower chance, also around 25 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomash. It's 10 minutes past the hour here in London. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Lagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yo Kosa.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumatanelia.
The Bropa Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, a year since the start of the uprising in Syria against President Bashar al-Assad, the violence inside the country continues to claim lives. Economic sanctions have done little to dent Assad's grip on power. Differences between Libya and Syria stretch beyond the international response. Assad's supporters are more radical, their loyalty harder to break. The Syrian government has placed restrictions on men of military age leaving the country. Joining me now to discuss the past 12 months and the path ahead for Syria is Patrick Coburn, the Middle East correspondent for The Independent. Patrick, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Firstly, Patrick, what we've heard today from one of Iraq's top diplomats about what the Arab League leaders will ask for of the regime, they won't demand the resignation of Assad. It looks as though Assad could cling on to his job. Is that feasible?
Yes, I think it is. I think the last month, even the last few weeks, have been pretty critical in his survival. If so, 3 or 4 months ago, international leaders, leaders in the Middle East, were talking about Assad as if his fall was inevitable, like Gaddafi. But the last month, it's become clear that there's no particular reason that he should fall this year or even next.
Why is that? What's occurred in this past month to change the tack?
I think a couple of very important things. One, that China and Russia and China vetoed the UN Security Council resolution about the change of regime. And that made it clear that there wasn't going to be any international military intervention. The Americans are backing away from it. The Ban Ki-moon said that nobody was talking about it now. So, you know, that's what brought down Gaddafi. And that's the only thing the Syrian government has to fear. I mean, there's guerrilla action and so forth by insurgent groups, but this is more of an irritant than a real threat.
It's hardly making a dent in the might that is Assad's military. And for some, that's always been the stumbling block in terms of the West's intervention there. The army there is so strong, where Libya had very little in the sense of an organized army.
Yes, I mean, there are a whole sort of series of things that are different. I mean, the protesters, the opposition to Assad, were trying to give the impression that, you know, the situations were similar, but they failed. They are different, that there were significant defections from the Gaddafi government early on. The rebels controlled a whole chunk of territory, most of eastern Libya, Benghazi and around there. The Gaddafi didn't really have any international allies who were prepared to go into bat for him. That's different with Bashar al-Assad in Damascus.
If not now, if we don't see Assad removed from power now, is it feasible that it'll ever happen? And will there be any intervention from the international community?
Well, you know, not to be too categorical at this stage, but it looks as though they're not going to do it, I mean, now or any time soon. There was talk about safe, no-fly zones, safe havens, but, you know, King Abdullah of Jordan, was saying safe havens, well, yeah, so long as it's a long way from Jordan. The Turks were talking about it, then they went cool about it. So I think that now what people are talking about is much more sort of moderate measures against Syria. Kofi Annan is talking about dialogue, saying the Syrians themselves must decide if Assad climbs down. So I think that, you know, one thing that was against him was a feeling of inevitability, that he was going to go like Mubarak had gone, Gaddafi had gone, Ali Abdullah Saleh had gone in Yemen. And that feeling of inevitability is no longer there.
The removal of EU sanctions, though, and these economic trade links and the travel ban that's been mooted with regards to the women closest to Assad and also his senior aides, would those be lifted anytime soon? How normal will things return?
I think they're kind of a smokescreen. You know, they're a way of saying we're still doing something. But hold on a minute. You know, a few months ago we were talking about foreign military intervention, of armies moving in, of air forces and so forth. And then and now we're talking about curtailing Mrs. Assad's shopping trips to Paris. Apparently she can still come to London, you know. So this is really pretty trivial stuff.
Yes. What do you think it says about now the options left to the West?
I think that a mistake was made early on by the Arab League, or in the last few months, and by outside forces, of going for broke. You know, at one moment there were Arab League monitors in Syria. They did have some impact on making it more difficult for Assad to suppress street protests. Street protests started getting big again. They were a sort of toe in the door of modifying the government's behavior. But then these were sort of treated contemptuously, because they didn't completely endorse the opposition's account of what was going on, and said that quite a lot of it was exaggerated and so forth. That then this was treated contemptuously. But I think that this was probably an opportunity lost. And in fact, what Kofi Annan seems to be proposing now of perhaps a UN mission to Syria sounds rather similar to what we had previously. So I think it's Saudi Arabia and its allies and some of its people in Western governments really overplayed their hands, thought they could get rid of Assad. This policy hasn't worked, and now they're sort of back to the drawing board.
And with regards to the man on the street in Syria, how likely is it that Syria will reunify, in a sense? Because you look at Libya now, even without Gaddafi, still a very divided country and warring now between the regions. It sounds like Syria was never that divided.
And, you know, look at Iraq, you know, warring there between Sunni and Shia. You know, look at Lebanon. You know, the civil war was meant to be over 20 years ago, but there's still, you know, conflict and friction and the threat of more conflict. So I'm afraid that that is really the prospect for Syrian future. I don't think the opposition is going to go away. I think it's going to be militarized. But I don't think it's going to be a real threat to the government in Damascus. They'll sort of, they'll hold the roads. They'll hold sort of strategic positions. But I doubt if they'll be able to eliminate guerrilla warfare. So I'm afraid it's a rather grim prospect for your ordinary Syrian, who's now facing, you know, what Lebanese and Iraqis faced in the past.
Lastly, Patrick, what do you think is the likely exit strategy for Assad, be it next year, in 5 years, however long we can expect?
He has one, you know. I think they've always been rather more confident than the outside world realized that they were going to win through. You know, there are things that might happen. You know, if there had been major defections by whole military units, if there'd been foreign intervention. But I think that they feel unless something changes, radical happens to change the current battle of forces, they're in business and they're going to stay in business, not just this year, next year, but far beyond.
OK, Patrick, we must leave it there. Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. Thank you for that. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Stay with us.
Monocle Films is the cinematic companion to the magazine. Our video journalists go off on location to capture on film stories from affairs to business, culture to design. This week, we focus our lens on sheep farms down under to witness the new bounce in the Australian merino wool industry.
Well, I'm fifth generation wool grower. Our property was started in 1830. We've been growing
superfine, ultrafine wool for 50 years here. I've always been interested in the land and looking after the livestock, and I've always enjoyed the sheep and the wool.
You can watch this and over 250 more films via the programs menu on monocle.com.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers, and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We can make it an eyesore in the community, or we can make it a shining jewel. And we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time in association with the Spanish Tourist Office.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, at the start of each week, we get an update on global affairs. And today we're joined by Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to tell us more. How are you, Steve?
Hello. Very good, thank you. Very good indeed. Should we start with North Korea?
Go on, yes. Very public what they're up to at the moment, isn't it?
Indeed. So North Korea are believed to have plans to launch a satellite sometime in mid-April to coincide with the centenary of the birth of the country's founder, Kim Il-sung. And there is a summit which is taking place, a nuclear summit in Seoul, capital of South Korea, which Barack Obama is at, and also Chinese President Hu Jintao. And they are saying they are going to coordinate a response to North Korea's rocket launch. So there is a suggestion that both the Americans and the Chinese are as wary as each other, which hasn't always been the case when it comes to North Korea.
Is there a reason to disbelieve what North Korea says about the aims of this satellite? It's deemed as a civilian satellite.
There's always a reason to disbelieve North Korea. Always, always, always. And particularly now with a new untested leader, Kim Jong-un, who's 28, 29, we're not entirely sure exactly how old, but young, and no one quite knows how he is going to respond to being in power. Is he going to be open to making some changes? Is he going to want to try and prove himself? That would be the fear, that he wants to prove himself. China has, ever since the USSR collapsed, China has been North Korea's strongest ally. And has been, in a sense, bankrolling it a lot of the time, providing him with a lot of support. China has some interest in keeping North Korea stable, and as a state, they don't want, they fear South Korea taking over. They wouldn't want US troops on their doorstep. But in recent years, they've become increasingly annoyed with the behaviour of Kim Jong-il and the leadership around him. And it's become quite clear that they are not entirely happy with the North Korean leadership, and on a situation like this, where it comes to nuclear weapons, are relatively happy to work with the US on trying to kibosh North Korea's attempts to antagonise the situation.
And in terms of North Korea's actions and its attitude, is it becoming more provocative under the new leader?
Too early to say. They were fairly provocative under Kim Jong-il. So we shall see. I mean, I think this is the first real sort of sign. The Americans call it a missile launch. The North Koreans say, oh, no, it's just satellite. This will be the first real test. So we shall see, I think. But that's something that's going to, the summit continues tomorrow. And then obviously this is going to go on for a while up until mid-April when this launch is expected to take place.
Right. Let's look to Europe now. And
yes.
The Eurozone and another country dealing with austerity measures that is Spain.
Mm. This is quite interesting. Mariano Rajoy is the new Spanish Prime Minister, the leader of the People's Party, which is their conservative party, their centre-right party. There was an election on Sunday in Andalusia, which is has a certain amount of autonomy. Ever since it has had that certain amount of autonomy, 1982, the socialists have always been in power in Andalusia. And this was the first time where it looked like they were going to lose control. And it looked like Rajoy's People's Party was going to win a majority. Turns out he didn't. They won the most seats, but not a majority. So now it looks like the socialists and the United Left, which is led by the communists, may well form a coalition. At the same time, This week, Rajoy is supposed to be unveiling his budget. It's, you know, he's described it as very, very austere. And it's supposed to be, it's rumoured to be around 40 billion euros worth of cuts. Whether he can get away with that and remain popular, because he is relatively popular, having just come into power not too long ago, remains to be seen. But it's, yeah, the markets are slightly concerned whether, you know, Spain's resolve on the issue is going to be tested on this.
And comparing it to Greece, where there was a lot of political deadlock right up until the 11th hour, when it seemed differences were brushed aside to get that deal signed, would things go as badly in Spain? Are they showing signs of greater consensus, at least?
It's difficult. I mean, Spain's got a huge unemployment problem, sort of more than 20% unemployment. Youth unemployment is approaching 50%. Really serious problems. I think we're not going to experience the same things that happened in Greece. The situation's very different. Spain, for example, actually pre the crash was actually fine. I mean, its debt levels were reasonable. It didn't have a deficit. So it's only really since the crash that it's become a crisis. They don't have the same sort of built-in economic problems that Greece has. And I think also the European leaders have learnt from how they've sort of muddled through with Greece, that they realise that, you know, if it does become a crisis, you need to sort of deal with it a bit quicker. So, I mean, I think we'll see what happens. It's not as simple as just saying, well, what happened in Greece is going to happen in Spain.
Has the political rhetoric in Spain changed since the crisis? Looking at that monumental shift politically in Andalusia, which was staunchly socialist, it's obviously sparked debate, and politicians latch on to that sense of disarray.
I don't know about the rhetoric, but, I mean, certainly there's been a lot of upheaval. You had you know, a big protest movement in Spain about a year ago of people on the left, you know, protesting actually against the centre-left government, the PSOE's government, led by Zapatero. And they, you know, a lot of the support that Rajoy got was more about the fact that people didn't approve of how Zapatero had run things, rather than a sort of a ringing endorsement of Rajoy's policies. And actually, their policies were relatively similar. They're both, you know, going down the austerity route. The socialists are now starting to sort of wonder whether that was too sensible, and, you know, starting to sort of flesh out some other options. But at the moment, I mean, I think, you know, Rajoy will be in power for a while, as he's only just been elected. We'll see what happens.
Okay, lastly, Steve, yes. A bit of a domestic one for the UK, cash for access. We've heard this sort of thing in many countries. It's causing David Cameron some problems, isn't it?
It is. So last week, David Cameron had a rather sort of botched budget, which was very easy for his opponents to label a budget for the rich, because despite the fact that, you know, this government is making cuts everywhere and has said, their phrase has been, we're all in it together, they decide to cut the top rate of tax from 50p in the pound to 45p. So a tax cut for the rich, which politically perhaps, you know, wasn't the smartest move. 3 or 4 days later, the Tory party's treasurer, a guy called Mr. Cruddas, was filmed by the Sunday Times newspaper claiming to sell access to David Cameron. He said, £100,000 is not Premier League. £250,000, that's Premier League. And he said, and for that, you know, you get into, you have dinner with Cameron, you have dinner with Osborne, you can make suggestions to the policy committee. So obviously David Cameron's in, you know, a little bit of sort of dodgy water right here.
And this is the latest in a long string of them, isn't it? We've had this in the last 6 months, several issues of the blurring lines with lobby groups and how much access they are promised.
Exactly, and it doesn't really sort of paint him in a very good light. Even though this is, you know, to a certain extent, this happens, you know, to all party leaders who, that, you know, they're trying to get money from people. And what do you give in return for money? You know, you have to give something, surely, other than just, you know, yeah, thanks. I mean, what do we expect these people want when they hand over large amounts of money? They're not doing it necessarily always for altruistic reasons. Some might be, but some might not. And this is going to run and run. I mean, it's been, you know, they had to make statements in the House of Commons today. David Cameron's had to release a list of everyone who's had dinner with him at his house, at number 10 in the flat. So, yeah, this will run all week, I feel.
That's a hard bargain, £200,000 for a dinner.
Better be good food.
It better had been. Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, thank you for that. You're with Midori House. Stay with us. We're back in just a second.
LDN TYO. NYC MT4.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be discussing the duel that's leaving one royal family divided. We'll also be hearing about the film that's tackling homophobia in the Balkans. But first, here's Georgina Godwin with the news headlines.
NATO officials have confirmed that an Afghan army soldier killed two British troops at their headquarters in southern Afghanistan today. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao have agreed to coordinate closely in responding to any potential provocation of a planned North Korean rocket launch. Kofi Annan said the crisis in Syria cannot drag on indefinitely, but that he could not set a deadline for a resolution after a year of bloodshed, whilst Presidents Obama and Medvedev have agreed to support Annan and agree on the best way forward to help the people of Syria. Israel has severed contacts with the UN Human Rights Council after it launched an international investigation last week into Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. The UN fact-finding team will now be prevented from entering the region. And Senegalese opposition candidate Macky Sall has emerged as the winner of yesterday's presidential election. Those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Georgina. Now I think it's time for some music. This is Impossible by Daniel Merriweather. That was Impossible by Daniel Merriweather. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Stay with us. We're back in just a second to talk Indian jewels. Now, it's one of the world's finest diamonds, found in 1853 by a Brazilian slave girl who was later rewarded with her freedom. It was worth £80,000 in the 19th century, and now the Star of the South, as it's known, is at the centre of legal dispute, which is dividing one of India's most distinguished royal families. Earlier, I spoke to Rachel Dwyer, a professor of Indian cultures and cinema SOAS at the University of London, who gave me some background on the stone and India's royal dynasties.
Jewel seems to have a very interesting history, having come from Brazil. And it seems to have been collected by one of the very interesting royal families of India. That's the Gaikwads of Baroda, as it used to be called, Vadodara now in Gujarat. And this was one of the top princely states of India. And they had a very interesting queen in the 1940s, who was called the Wallis Simpson of India, who acquired jewellery, but also seems to have been responsible for taking some of the state jewellery to Europe. Because after independence, the princely states, which had been separate from British India, had to amalgamate into the Indian Union, which was a socialist republic. So I think the princes pretty much saw the writing on the wall then. You know, in the 1970s, they lost their privy purses and titles. So people began to take jewellery out of India. And I think at some point, this wonderful gem went missing.
So it wasn't really theirs to take out of the country.
Well, it belonged to the state treasury. And it's always this problem, you know, it's a bit like with the Kohinoor and give it back to India. Well, you know, it'd probably go back to Pakistan if we gave it back to anybody. But where do you give back? You know, how do things that belong to royal families and princely states then become part of modern states? It's never clear.
This claimant, the Maharaja of Baroda, what is his argument as to his claim to this jewel?
Well, first of all, technically there isn't a Maharaja of Baroda because the princely states were abolished in 1971. But people still use the titles, not so much the people themselves, but other people. So it would be a demand to have it back for the state treasury. But if I gather rumour has it it's been on the market in Amsterdam, but I don't know if that's true. But that would be quite interesting because, as you know, the Jewish families that used to control the diamond trade in Amsterdam have largely been replaced by Gujarati families.
Oh, really?
So, you know, there'd be quite a little network there.
Yeah. There's no confirmed location then of this jewel?
Not that I know of. And I think anybody who had it certainly wouldn't be telling us.
Are these sorts of feuds and battles over these jewels that as yet have not been located, they're becoming more and more common now, aren't they?
Wherever there's money in a family, there's a fight. And in India, there isn't a system of primogeniture like we have here, which makes a dispute small bitter. I always tell my students when they ask about these things, I always say, well, you know, the two big Indian epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, are basically about family squabbles. You know, every family that has power and money has a fight, and that's just what we're seeing here. But it's about jewellery, it's about land, it's about prestige, it's about so many things that it's really very sad, though, to see families at war with each other like this.
And in a very public way.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, people know, you know, which side are you on?
Is it becoming quite a divisive issue in India? Do people take sides?
I think in India at the moment, although there have been some very interesting exhibitions about the royal families of late, people are now interested in the kind of new royalty of India. That's these superbly wealthy merchants. I mean, the Ambani name springs to mind immediately, of course, but also the Bollywood royalty. And their, you know, magazines, newspapers just live on the gossip. I mean, they have something there called page three culture, which isn't topless lovelies as it is here, but it's actually about society pages. Every society likes gossip.
Absolutely. You have this establishment here, though, from a bygone era, and it from, you know, face value looks as though their wealth has a finite sum on it, hence why these jewels have become so important and you're seeing more legal battles, because these families have less growth in their income compared to the nouveau riche of India.
I'm not a gambling person, but were I to gamble, I bet it would be an Indian who's going to buy this jewel somehow. Not because so much of its heritage. I mean, it is Brazilian. It's not like it's a diamond from the Golconda mines or something like that. But the new money and the buying money, as we know, is coming a lot from these BRIC countries. I mean, even the shops in London, you know, the department stores have areas that really cater for BRIC customers who are more flash, who like more colour, more glamour than Westerners nowadays do. And, you know, I think the jewel buying is going on there. So there was a very funny story about this Maharana of Baroda I found, which is that she had anklets which had emeralds and diamonds in them, which she sold to Harry Winston. And Wallace Simpson is meant to have bought them and had them made into a necklace. Now, in India, anything that's been near your feet is somehow polluted. And apparently the Maharani announced very loudly, "I think they look as good on your neck as they did on my feet."
Oh,
and they
nice.
Were never worn again.
I should think not. It sort of rules them out as potential buyers as well.
Yeah.
Is there a newer sense of greed now in India, do you think? It's led by Western media and the new media of India, and this approach to valuables, like that, more so than there ever has been in the past amongst Indians?
It's very hard to say. I mean, is it greed or is it just excitement at new wealth? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it does always seem obscene that some people have so much money when others have so little. But I don't really see the moral difference between whether you actually live in India or live in the West and have the money. To me, it doesn't make so much difference. I mean, obviously, we'd like to see more philanthropy going on, but that'll come. You know, the wealth is still quite new for these people. I think that these people are very interested in buying jewellery, not just us. We would be in the West. I think it's very important to consider what jewellery means in India, which is something quite different from here. When a woman, a Hindu woman, gets married, she leaves her natal home, and her wealth is the jewellery that her parents give her. That never belongs to her husband's family. So her bangles, her earrings, her necklaces, any gold is hers and hers alone. And this story that a woman is a Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth in the house, and the fact that for the new year, one of the days is the worship of gold, I think we can see that jewellery and gold have a very different role in Indian culture from what it has in the West? I mean, people always say if Indian women sold their gold, they could pay off the national debt. But, you know, even a quite modest family in India would own a good deal of jewellery. So it's not surprising if the very rich families are going to own phenomenal quantities.
It seems unlikely anybody would hand this back, even if it was located.
I mean, I don't think it's illegally gone, is it? I think it's a mystery where it's gone.
And it's his claim that it was taken illegally. That still hasn't been confirmed or established.
I mean, I'm sure it's something like the Nizam of Hyderabad, who, I can't remember which diamond it was, but used it as a paperweight. I'm sure somebody has that diamond very safely somewhere and is getting a great deal of pleasure even from looking at it in secret.
That was Professor Rachel Dwyer of the Indian Cultures and Cinema SOS. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back to discuss a new film sensation in the Baltics just after this.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, there's a new film sensation in the Balkans. Parada, or The Parade, combines homosexuals and soldiers. No mean feat. Yet this tale's receiving more views than the Hollywood blockbuster Avatar. In Bosnia, that is. The award-winning film introduces a group of gay activists trying to organise a pride parade in Belgrade, challenging the region's deep-rooted homophobia and ethnic divide. Here's a clip of the film.
После певаљки, ратних профитера,
српски херој,
лим,
чува, педер.
Пробаћу да направим екипу ван Београда.
Čekam je u kolima.
Pa ja.
Osoblje!
Krvavu ti nedelju jebem stopu četnička.
Pa gde si, pičko ustaška?
A ti, gdje si ti ratova?
A nisam stigao zbog škole da se uključim. Šta te?
So the film's been equally acclaimed in Serbia, Croatia and Bosnia, something that no local film has achieved since the 1990s. So what is the secret of its success and what impact does it hope to make? Joining us on the line now is Dijan Djokic, a director of the Centre for Study of the Balkans at Goldsmiths University. Firstly, Dijan, looking at what this film is about, it's very much references to real events. The last gay pride march that was in the making in Belgrade didn't go smoothly and in fact was cancelled at the last minute, but then we still saw violent scenes on the streets of Belgrade. Does this film make direct reference to that, and is that needed at a time when things look very volatile there?
Yes, I think the film does make a direct reference to that, and in fact the director Srđan Dragojević has stated in several interviews that he wanted to make a direct reference to the cancelled gay pride last year. The year before, however, gay pride was held in Serbia for the first time in Belgrade, but it was then interrupted by a violent mob that clashed with the police, and central Belgrade was pretty much smashed. Shops and windows were smashed by those mobs. So last year the government decided to actually cancel, or rather they said that they couldn't provide, they couldn't secure the parade. And in fact, this is what the film is about. The film, in fact, tells the story of two gay guys in Belgrade who decide to organize a gay pride march, but the police tells them that they couldn't actually guarantee their safety. So they approached a homophobic gangster who runs a security agency, a bodyguard agency in Belgrade, who is persuaded to help them by his trophy girlfriend.
With a view on what happened in Belgrade last year and the year before, where you have these anti-gay protesters causing such violence in the city, is it a surprise that this film has been so warmly received in Serbia?
Yes, well, that's a very good question. It is a bit of a surprise because I remember reading about the film when it was being made and reading about it on various internet sites, and readers' comments were not always very friendly, and so I didn't think the film would be such a success. I don't think anybody thought, apart from the director, I think, who says that he was fairly confident that it would be a success. But I think even he has been surprised. Not just in Serbia. I think it's important to stress that there is that homophobia is spread throughout the region. I mean, there was a similar incident in Croatia, in Split, in Croatia last year as well. But also, the film is actually hugely popular in Croatia. It's a box office hit in Croatia as well. As well as in Bosnia-Herzegovina, as well as in Montenegro, which is possibly the most traditional society in former Yugoslavia. So yes, this is a bit of a surprise. However, when one thinks about it, I think one needs to consider several issues. First of all, the director is already hugely popular. He directed two films in the 1990s that were also regional hits. One was Pretty Village, Pretty Flame, which I think is also relatively well known in the West. It did attract some positive reviews in Western Europe and in the States when it was released. It's a film about the war in Bosnia. And the second one is called The Wounds, which is his depiction of the Milosevic years in Belgrade, which was actually the first Serbian film to be released in Croatia with subtitles, even though the language is the same. So that was a bit of a controversy there as well in the late 1990s. So the director is already relatively well known and popular, and some of the main actors in the film are also well known throughout the region. And the film is a comedy, so it can be it's a light comedy in on the surface at least. And I think that those are several factors that could help explain the popularity of the film. But if you just, if I may say a few more things, and I'm sorry if I'm going on, but I think there is one other interesting subplot here, which I think has been neglected by many viewers in the West, observers in the West. And this is, the film also tells a story about the cooperation between Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims and Kosovo Albanians, who actually get together and try to protect, to secure the gay, to make sure that the gay parade takes place. So there is this also a story about the inter-ethnic cooperation in a society that was in a state of conflict until not so long ago. So I think that's another very, very interesting aspect of the film, which again is maybe not easy to explain.
Absolutely, and certainly be interesting to see whether or not next year's parade or the one later this year in Belgrade goes ahead. Dean, we must leave it there. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for that. It's Dean Djokic from the Centre for Study of the Balkans at Goldsmiths University. Stay with us on Midori House. We're back in just a second. Now, much great modern music's explicitly a product of a specific urban environment, a place. One thinks of The Clash's London, Bruce Springsteen's New Jersey, Bob Marley's Kingston, places that come alive on record, even for people who've never been there. Using this idea as a springboard, British DJ and producer Nick Luscombe has founded Musicity, a location-based music platform intended to explore the intersection of music, place, memory, and experience. A little earlier, Monocle's culture editor Robert Bounds spoke to him to find out more.
You take the city as your sort of as your muse, I guess, and with great success in London. Was Tokyo always your next choice? And if it was, why?
Yeah, it was my dream choice, to be honest, just because I've got, just a lot of love for the city. And it's just, I don't know, it doesn't have a lot of love for itself, especially at the moment. I think people feel kind of, there's a lot of things have happened over the last 12 months. And, you know, I think it's a city that's kind of, you know, far from on its knees, but just maybe just needs a little bit of a booster. And for me, I've always loved this place, and it was a kind of natural second city to work in with, you know, such incredible architecture and such interesting music. So yeah, I'm really happy that it's all happening.
And do you take, I mean, I think immediately of a band like Saint-Étienne, like a London band that always writes songs about their home city. Is there the equivalent in Tokyo? I mean, are there you know, contemporary musicians that riff on the kind of streets and sights of Tokyo?
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, we had a discussion last night at a little club called Domune, where we had a few artists and producers who work on a musicista here in Tokyo. And I don't think it happens that often, to be honest, but I think part of the reason why the songs are quite interesting is that they really, you know, the musicians involved have really connected with their city and like listing different areas and different aspects. And I think people are starting to look at the kind of history of, you know, music in Tokyo as well, looking at different areas maybe that, you know, were famous for the acid jazz movement that came from the UK, and the kind of history of Japanese club culture as well. So I think we may have kind of encouraged people a little bit to kind of just engage on that level with their city.
Nice. And where's the music performed? I mean, is I guess people are obviously using the city as a muse, as we said, but are they playing the tracks about the places in the places that they're writing the tracks about, or is it a sort of headphone experience?
Yeah, well, it's a headphone experience basically with a smartphone. You get a web app through the website. You put it on your phone, and then when you get to the location, you basically sign in, you log into an account, and then you just walk around to different parts of the city. Obviously your phone knows where you are because of GPS, and then you can stream the track at the location that the music has been written about, if that makes sense. And then when you get home, you can listen to the track by downloading it onto your computer. So it's a very much a locative experience. And the idea is to try and encourage people to kind of move around the city and collect these tracks, you know, and engage on a slightly different level.
And can you tell, I mean, I'm reminded of something like W.G. Sebald, you know, the German author that walked around Suffolk and he sort of walked down a sort of oak-lined country lane, and it reminded him of something else. He'd end up writing sort of an entire chapter about the Chinese kind of Silk Road. And is it that sort of thing? I mean, do you think the connections between the place and the music that you've experienced so far are quite obvious? A busy place is kind of busy music and more kind of gardeny places more chilled, or do people kind of take their inspiration, let it go for a bit of a walk?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think you know, the tracks that have come out of this have been very personal to those different artists, I think. So you know, I'm not an expert in Japanese, and there's a lot of lyrics involved, and I haven't actually checked all of them out yet, but I know, I mean, one example is that Fink, who's we've got four artists from the UK who've collaborated. Or they made tracks about Japan, Tokyo, or they've collaborated. And Fink's never actually been to Japan, but he's got, you know, ideas in his head of how the city sounds. And he's made a very beautiful piece of music in collaboration with a Vocaloid, which is a kind of robot singer called Miku Hatsune, who's a massive J-pop star here. So, you know, between them, they've kind of come up with this sort of fantasy of Tokyo as well, which is interesting. So I think all the tracks are very personal to each individual artist, to be honest.
And it sounds, I mean, it maybe sounds to our listeners like there's obviously an element of soundtrack to it. It's soundtracking a city, I suppose, in a bit more oblique way than like a film score. But have you found that that quality, sort of soundtrack quality coming out in some of this stuff? I mean, like vocals, I guess, take it away from that territory a bit. But is there an element of that?
There is. I mean, for example, Stuart from Cinematic Orchestra, he's written a track called The Seventh Tree, and it's you know, it's almost like as you'd imagine, you know, with the influence of a band like that, who are, you know, incredibly obviously cinematic, and he's stepped into that world completely. I can't wait to hear it tomorrow at the location, just to see, you know, what it sounds like listening to that and looking around, you know, all these amazing buildings. So yeah, I think it, you know, you're right with some of the vocal tracks. Maybe it doesn't sound quite so filmic or cinematic, but yeah, maybe they will. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what it's like here in Japan when we listen to them at midnight tomorrow night, and all the craziness of all the people and all the neon. It should be exciting, I think.
So that's the sort of grand reveal. Does each location get its song revealed at different times, or I mean, have you got feedback from people yet as to sort of, you know, well, no, having a look at their faces while they download the app and put their earphones in?
That's right. Well, we'll find out tomorrow. We're going to I think it all kicks off around 6 o'clock tomorrow, just when it's sort of getting dark here in Tokyo, and that's when the whole thing will open and all the tracks will be available at the same time. And then leading up to that, there'll be live performances at different locations from some of the artists as well. So we're going to be kind of working a lot in the Mori building, the Mori Art Gallery. So and then we've got DJ sessions from about midnight till about 3 a.m. as well. So we're going to, we're going to keep it going as much as we can and mix live performance, DJ, and and then the headphone experience as well.
And as was the founder of Musicity, Nick Luscombe. And that is all we have time for on this Monday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time to start the day in Asia. But next on Monocle 24, just after the news with Georgina, we have the Culture Show with Robert Bound. So stay tuned for that. From all of us, though, and the Midori House team, goodbye.